you know, a sacred number, not...
Well, the 15-1 in your report is tied to branded drugs. I don't believe there's a reference in your report to the 11% rebate on the generics.
No, and that's negotiable also, isn't it?
That would, yeah, that, and, well, that's the federal rebate. I don't know. That's something you'd have to ask the agency about, because that's not something we're...
Well, I know, Mr. Chair, last session we talked about getting a higher rebate rate for generics, and it just kind of fell on the wayside someplace, but I think it's something that's askable.
Well,
or
I
negotiable,
mean,
at least.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, the bottom line for this is the more that the state can bulk purchase, I think the better your bargaining power is. And I think one of the things that has sort of been kicked around, at least in the side conversations, is you not only bulk purchase for the Medicaid population, perhaps you bulk purchase for PEP and some of the others. And if you can do that, then you have a larger leverage for negotiating your rebates.
But isn't 15-1 the best we can do?
You'd have to ask someone in state government, because I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. Mr. McCullough.
Jeff, is that model you're proposing, has this been tested, tried in other states, or is this basically kind of a hybrid that...
This is a creation of our own thought patterns.
Okay.
On item 4, which is prior authorization for fee-for-service clients, this is related to both cost management and medical management. If the state adopts the recommendations 1 through 3 in any format, this item will be largely addressed under the FCHP or ASO contracts. And there's several references in here in your report that, frankly, as if you move towards a managed care model for this population, you're going to take care of some of these items automatically, and this would be one of them. With regard to auditing the state's PBM, we support this as part of a larger strategy to better administer the prescription drug program, and certainly need to reevaluate its contract if it moves to the bulk purchasing model. So we would support it. In terms of Tier 1 OHP delivery system actions, item 6, which is the CMS waivers and moving the line, we do support moving the line. And certainly our medical directors are ready, willing, and able to help with any medical expertise in that area. Item 7, putting limitations on comorbid conditions and ancillary services, we would support this recommendation. We think it makes a lot of sense and for the reasons that were cited in your report. Item 8, management of durable medical equipment. This falls again under the move towards the managed care or ASO model, and we would support that because we think that we certainly have the pieces in place to make that work much more effectively as far as costs. Item 9, reduction in FCHP capitation by paying DRG services at OMAP rates plus 10%. This is a recommendation that we cannot support as it's stated. We calculated the rate reduction based on the stated savings that were in your report. It would reduce the capitation payment approximately $17 per member per month, and that is 26% of the 0305 capitation rate. And frankly, we don't believe that that's sustainable, and we did not understand the logic within that recommendation. It assumes that the plans will be paying 10% over OMAP rates for DRG services. Many of the plans are paying OMAP rates for some hospital inpatient services as it is, and this would create a great deal of uncertainty for the capitated health plans. There may be some savings in changing the payment methodology for hospitals in both the fee-for-service and capitated programs. And we will be providing the committee at a later date with recommendations as how that may be accomplished. But this one was I would say confusing is not the right word. We did not understand how it could be accomplished, and particularly with the dollars that were being proposed. It was a huge figure for us, especially since most of us are now, using other things to pay for other parts of the capitation rate to pay for hospital services. So it was that was one of which we have a great deal of trouble with.
Well, I have one communication to make to you.
Right.
It's not even verbal. It's...
Right.
We'll figure this one out.
Yes, and that, we wanted that clear in that last sentence. We'll work with you on it. Item 10 is lower price WaterhouseCoopers projected reimbursement to FCHPs. And this was pretty much related to the 8% administration. And we would oppose this without a corresponding reduction in contractual requirements. The contractual requirements placed on the fully capitated health plans for administering the Oregon Health Plan are quite extensive, and most of our administrative budgets are in the area of medical, disease, and pharmacy management, which are required by our contracts, and something which I think you all have determined in your deliberations are fairly important to keeping costs reasonable and services directed in the appropriate forms. We successfully argued several years ago that the 6% fee we were receiving did not cover costs and meant that we had to use part of the medical budget to subsidize them. If you reduce the administrative fee, we'll have to go back to that system. We have one bucket here where we get our money, and that is from the premium we receive from OMAP. So if you choose to move money out of the quote administrative fee, I can tell you can do that. But the bottom line is we will have to cover those costs now under our current contract, and so we would just be picking some of that money out of the medical budget in order to do it.
Well, and I think, as you'll recall, we went and we fully cost-trended, for cost utilization and reimbursement. We put the full PricewaterhouseCoopers amount in there. I mean, we're going to have to reduce some off of that.
Right.
And I think everyone understands that, and the question is where do we get to?
Right.
And what works? You guys have to be able to make a market. It has to be a two-way street here.
Yeah. Well, I think we're looking more at utilization and some hydraulics to get some control there more than their reimbursement rates. So.
Okay. Item 11, cut fees to certain fee-for-service providers while maintaining or increasing fully capitated plans reimbursements. The plans would be uncomfortable with any reduction in reimbursement to physicians who are providing fee-for-service services. As far as we can tell, this would only serve to reduce access in those areas where you don't have managed care plans. We don't think that, frankly, is healthy. These are not, our providers, but certainly, we think that the physicians are getting paid about as low as you can pay them in the first place, and further reducing that does not incentivize anybody. There's a larger discussion that we believe that needs to take place with regard to rate setting for FCHPs in those areas where we do not currently operate, in the fee-for-service areas. There needs to be much more a discrete process for setting rates in the rural areas that addresses A and B hospital costs, provider access, and ancillary service costs. Now, the rural areas are really where you don't have the plans operating. And I've explained this several times to individuals, but, what you have now is the premiums for the rural areas are basically set on a rate band basis, and there is one rate band that starts right at the Cascades, takes in the entire eastern side of the Cascades, misses Jackson, Josephine County, and then comes up the coast. And that's called the other group. And the other group has one rate for that entire population. And that's regardless whether you're talking about Bend in the Deschutes County area, whether you're talking about Wasco County, where the Dalles is, Curry County down on the coast, Baker City, Baker County. It's the same rate fits all. And because of the A and B methodology and because those areas have considerably different access issues, considerably different needs in their community for certain services, one rate doesn't do it. And so what we would recommend is that there be a more discrete breaking out of those rates so that you can balance. I mean, we took a look at Baker County at one time. The rate will not support the hospital costs there. Now, that doesn't mean the hospital is wrong. It just means that the needs of that community and the needs of that hospital to serve that community are different than they are in Bend. And yet we get the same rate in whichever county you operate in. So in order to really emphasize, or if you're looking to move into more fully capitated health plan management of these areas, you've got to have a different rate methodology for the rural areas.
Yeah, and obviously, just to call your attention to something you wrote, you know, on the next page there. I mean, all we're trying to do is figure out a mechanism, you know, to get fee for service into fully capped.
Correct.
The whatever that is, I think the panel's comfortable with it.
Right.
Jeff is first.
Okay.
What?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Oh, me, Jeff. There's one over here, too. In this Eastern Oregon / Coastal band, how many DRG hospitals are there? Two? Three?
Probably St. Charles.
Yeah, three.
And that may be it. St. Charles and Bend. Maybe okay.
Hood River?
Maybe the only. No, I think Hood River and the Dalles are Feeper.
Middle
The A and B's.
What's Pendleton?
Pendleton is a type A.
Okay. Okay. I mean, does the fact that St. Charles is in that band weigh it that much heavily against the others, or?
Yes.
Okay.
And frankly, you've got, for instance, Mid-Columbia up in the Dalles,
mm-hmm.
is a type B hospital. But St. Charles has a catchment area that includes not only Oregon, but a huge group of Washington as you go up Highway 97. And a large part of those people are commercially insured. So the profile for that hospital is different than it is for, say, Curry General Hospital, where I think it's something like 65% of all of the revenue they get is from government programs. So, you know, their needs are totally different. But the rate doesn't take into account those differences.
Could you come up with a different map?
New band.
Yes. It'll take us a little while, but we could.
I would be interested in seeing that.
We'd be glad to do that.
Okay. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff, I don't think on item 11 there's really disagreement between the committee and what you're looking at here. It was cut fees to certain fee-for-service providers. I think we're looking there at counties that could have but don't have health plans, and we're looking at counties with a health plan and needs to encompass everyone in the county you possibly can. Your second paragraph there speaks to that. So I think this may be a communication problem amongst us more than anything else. I think we're all aiming for the same thing. We want people to plan. And we don't want to incent people to leave the plans, and we don't want providers to be incented to leave the plans either, right?
Correct. Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, you do realize that sometimes we do try to be very politically correct.
Yes, I appreciate that.
The second issue under this one, and I brought it up because it did show up in the testimony on Thursday about those counties where you do have fully capitated health plans and a large number of the unenrolled. A large number of the people who are enrolled are not assigned to the plans. It took a little while for my memory to kick in. Historically, OMAP has said that 8% of a population in a fully capitated county is not enrollable for the reasons that were cited. They have third-party resources. They're on end-stage kidney disease, a number of things. Plus just the churn rate that goes on a month-by-month basis. And we don't have any quarrel with the 8%, but you have a number of counties where there's a great deal of disparity between the number of assigned and the 8% figure. And we think, frankly, that DHS should be encouraged to be much more aggressive in assigning those to plans. And I use the term DHS because OMAP does not assign people to plans. That is handled by AFS. There are exceptions that are granted by SDSD and AFS workers. And OMAP basically doesn't have much to say about it. We've asked, for instance, that the Portland Tri-County area is now mandated, which means that all of the people on the PLUS population should be assigned to a fully capitated health plan. If you take a look at the numbers, even in going into the second month, that has hardly moved. You've got Marion Polk County down here where you've got 12,000 unassigned. If you use the 8% figure, you'd only have 4,000 people who are unassigned. And we can give you examples of county by county how that's happening. So there needs to be a little bit of a kick in the pants on this particular issue.
That's one issue. I mean, clearly we need to be more aggressive in picking folks up, but I'm just wondering if I heard you wrong. Because I've been assuming for the categorical population there's not a lot of churning, but you're saying there's 8% churning in that population?
No, I said within that 8% you have people with third-party resources.
Right.
And churning's probably not the right word. You have people who are coming onto the plan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, prior to them being assigned. So you have a population that's sort of in limbo before they get assigned to a plan. And then you have, some of the conditions where they're in their third trimester of pregnancy or they're end-stage renal or whatever. That is what OMAP says adds up to about 8%. Mm-hmm. And that's a traditional figure that they've used since the beginning of the PCO program.
Well, this is just a management issue more than anything, isn't it?
Correct. Correct. Item 12, carve out severe and persistent mental illnesses. What we support here is the integration of mental health and physical medicine services. Most of the care and cost of these patients is in the physical medicine area, and it makes better sense to have these patients managed through the FCHPs rather than the MHO model. And that's simply because we have the providers in place to do that. It's a twist, but we think that in terms of management that would be better. I'm getting prompted here. So Tier 1, DHS management actions. Third-party collection of resources. Items 13 and 14, frankly, again, as if you move towards a managed care model for your patients, we think these will be taken care of. In item 15, we don't have any real comments. We think it's a good thing to look at in terms of non-emergency management. But it's not, within our issues, and we haven't taken it on, so we'd just say probably it's a good idea. 16, evaluate and contract with third-party administrators. As you know, we fully support this concept. You've heard from several plans about the benefits of local management of services, and most of the FCHPs are capable of providing this option within their current service areas and can develop capability in other areas fairly quickly. The analysis of this option that was on your report listed as a cost item with low feasibility and high effort, we would not agree with that assessment. We think it's frankly fairly easy to do, and we believe that there would be a cost savings by aggressive management of this population. Item 17, evaluate and expand disease management. We support that recommendation. And again, that falls under the overall recommendation for moving these people into a managed care. We would say that, this is best accomplished, we believe, at a local level where you have the relationships built up, the experience that commercial insurers have had with third-party vendors, out-of-state vendors has not been positive. Using local resources has produced a much better participation and compliance among the providers. Item 18 is improved eligibility screening. The contractors feel very strongly that this is an issue that needs to be addressed. And we certainly see people that we have a great deal of question about coming through. I think there's a cost-benefit thing as to how much energy you expend on this population, but certainly there ought to be, I think, a little bit better working relationship. First of all, do it at the front end. Catch them at the front end with staff who are capable of making those decisions and with rules that certainly support finding the people who shouldn't be on the plan. The second thing is to work with the contractors more closely so that when we identify people who clearly do not meet the eligibility requirements, that we can get them off. We see those, and we've all had experiences basically fighting with the agency as to saying, look, they don't belong on the plan, they aren't living in the state, they don't meet certain requirements, and we don't get the kind of cooperation we believe there should be to remove them from eligibility. Item 19. Yes.
Two questions, if I may. First, why is it in the plan's best interest to try and get people off who are living out of state? I mean, they're obviously low users. I mean, why is it anybody's interest not to get them off, but why is it the plan's interest to get them off? If they're living in Pennsylvania, that's great, on a capitation system.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, the unfortunate thing is that these people return to us when they have medical difficulty. And so when they come back to us and they're in a difficult situation, we wind up with the bill. And so we want to make sure that people who are living out of state are not really carried on the plan, because while they're living out of state, they're not visiting, they're living. And so we want to make sure that those folks are not receiving an Oregon Health Plan benefit.
May I follow up? It seems to me if somebody is out of state for 3 or 4 months and you're collecting a premium and then they show up and they need care, that's not a whole lot different than if they had stayed in state for those 3 or 4 months and then showed up and they need care. I understand the eligibility issues and I understand the right and wrong and legal and all that, but I'm not sure I understand why you all care if you've collected premiums in that interim period.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, oftentimes the folks move, and you have to remember that we've only recently moved to collection of a monthly premium. And so when folks move out of the state, and I would suspect that given the situation that folks are in now, they would not continue paying their premium. But again, we have a new plan given OHP2 and a new way of looking at this. And so I think it's important for us to keep our finger on the pulse of the situation and make the appropriate evaluation based on our budget issues.
And under the recommendations we put out of this committee, there is no such thing as a premium.
No, I understand perfectly why, from our perspective and from the state's perspective, if somebody's living in Pennsylvania, you don't want to be paying a premium to Care Oregon of X dollars per month when they're not really at risk. I'm just probing for why Care Oregon cares that they get paid a premium of, I don't know the number, $100 a month for 4 months while these people are living in Pennsylvania. I mean, it seems to me it would be.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Greenlick, it's not that they have. I think the best way to say this is, if they're not a resident of Oregon, they should not be collecting a benefit from us.
I agree. But your sense that you're being good citizens and trying to get them off, and the state won't take them off, seems to me the incentives in the wrong place. Seems like weird incentives to me.
Well, that's good public policy. If they're not residents of the state of Oregon, then.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think the other piece of this is that there have been anecdotal stories of people who come into the state for the purposes of getting services and only for that period of time when they need them. And I think, you know, that this is the eligibility screening that's really being talked about here.
Sure.
And I know that there are situations where you have people just north of the border here on the Columbia River who have signed up for the Oregon Health Plan because they don't qualify for the Washington program. So, you know, it's frankly those kind of people that we think ought to be excluded.
Yeah. You don't have any questions? We certainly agree with that.
Item 19, review of the administrative requirements. We strongly support this recommendation. And I would say that we believe that a portion of any savings that you're looking for here have to be generated through technology upgrades. The department cannot produce any reasonable results using 30-year-old technology, which they currently have. And you know, quite frankly, any business would fail if it took as long as most of our agencies take to upgrade their technology. And without being too unkind, the legislature has a role to play in this. Slowdown. But, you know, we're asking them to do, you know, freeway traffic with mules at this point in terms of technology. We also think that there is always a benefit to be derived if you take a good hard look at the entire structure of your administrative rules, your oversight methodologies, and your paperwork loads. But then you're talking about bringing in consultants, which, of course, is another cost. But it's pretty cumbersome to work with DHS, and part of it is just the inertia of the system and part of its technology, and we would certainly encourage a thorough look at how that's done. In terms of the Tier 2 prescription drug cost containment and OHP service delivery actions, items 1 through 6, dealt with prescription drugs. Again, we would refer the committee back to your primary recommendations in terms of prescription drug cost containment, because we think these items would be taken care of if you operationalized your original cost containment recommendations in Tier 1. Item 7 is to reinstate the PCO model. PCO model was abandoned in favor of the fully capitated model in 1996, so the state could assign 100% risk to the FCHPs. We didn't object to that, and we supported it, actually, and we don't now. We think that the 100% risk model is probably the best for both for the plans and for the state. Allowing PCO development might allow more managed care in some current fee-for-service areas. I think you'd have to be careful about that. And you'd have to compare it to an ASO-type model. Either way would certainly, I think, be appropriate to take a look at. However, the rates would have to be sufficient, and we go back, as we do more than once, to the current rate-setting model, which we think needs to be revised. Overall, we believe that the FCHP model is the best because it offers better budget predictability and cost containment, and we would oppose any effort to put the PCO model next to FCHPs in the same service area. We think that starts splitting up the thing a little too much. Item 8, FCHP management of all aspects of the fee-for-service clients and services. We've talked about that before, and we do agree with that. Item 9, with regard to block grants, we do not foresee that this recommendation is any different from the current premiums being paid to the plans in terms of budget. If rate sufficiency is the issue in the current premiums, the block grant sufficiency would be the same issue. The costs simply are not going to change because you adopt a different methodology of paying the plans for them. This projected cost savings of $10 million is counterintuitive to us as to how you would achieve that in a block grant form versus 100% risk model that you have now. And if someone, you know, has a good idea of how that's done, we'd be glad to consider, but we couldn't figure out how you would achieve any savings
Well, we could shift the payment into the next biennium.
You solved the budget problem.
Stop the tape. Let's back it up. We'll take that on the record. Representative March.
Item 10, eliminate cost-based reimbursement to A and B hospitals. We believe that the payments for A and B hospitals need to reflect the needs of the individual institutions and their communities. One size does not fit all. A carefully designed flexible payment structure that incorporates DRGs has the potential to provide a more equitable reimbursement to those rural areas based on need rather than the current methodology. And I'll go back to the example I used about the rate band. You know, that there are some hospitals in the A and B world which have been consistently profitable, and consistently profitable sometimes even in the double-digit areas. And you stack those up against some of the A and B hospitals who have been consistently hard-pressed to meet their needs, and Curry General is a perfect example down in Brookings of a hospital that has continually struggled for years. Well, you know, in my opinion, and not COLO's, you know, those are the hospitals that ought to be getting a little extra bump, where you have some of the more solid hospitals, I guess the best way, most politically correct way to put that, that probably shouldn't be getting as much of a bump. I think you could do it and be budget neutral. But I certainly think there's a better methodology than we have now for recognizing what the true needs of some of these community hospitals are out in rural areas. With that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that's the end of our formal presentation. I think we would like to say one thing that a lot of what we are looking forward to as in terms of the plans certainly is that we look forward to, you know, handling as much as possible of this population as we can, helping you devise the methodologies and strategies that will get us there. We always have the caveat that basically, and we know you understand it, but we'll say it again for the record, that the rates have to be sufficient for the services that are being required and to meet, you know, meet the needs of our providers, or they won't come. We do know that the committee has been looking at that rate setting methodology. We certainly encourage you to continue to do so, and to look for other alternatives, frankly, in how we may go about the rate setting process as we move forward. The other comment I would make is, if you do have questions, things you want us to bring back, we do. Bill Murray and a couple of the contractors will be here on Wednesday. And we told them that we would take all of your questions and forward them to them for answers. So with that, I don't know if Ruby wants to say anything, but
both on, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on Wednesday and Thursday, as well as tomorrow, you'll be hearing from contractors, and there are some more specifics that they will be focusing on, as Jeff said. The medical directors will be in on Thursday.
Could you get that microphone a little closer, sure, speak louder, or a
the
combination of both?
Medical directors will be in on Thursday and be able to provide you with some details relative to medical management, and I know that you've been looking forward to that, medical management, disease management, and some discussion relative to the line, moving the line. And so I wanted you to kind of prepare your questions there, and if there are questions that can be provided in advance through Mr. Brakovian, we would take those by email and pass them on to our medical directors. On Wednesday, Care Oregon's new CEO, whom a lot of you had an opportunity to meet a couple weeks ago, will also be joining the Bills, Bill and Bill, Guest and Murray. And you'll have an opportunity then to talk with him specifically about some of the experiences he has had throughout the country relative to Medicaid populations. And so he is looking forward to that, and I'm sure that you'll have lots of questions for him as well. That's it. We thank you, and we'll take any questions that you have now.
Representative Cruz.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're talking about integration of mental and physical health in relation to the severe and persistent. Are you willing to, how much of the risk that's out there are you willing to assume in that? Are you willing to assume the risk the counties are now assuming?
It all depends, Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, it all depends on the numbers. If the numbers are sufficient, yes. And Family Care has an MHO contract, so we have been assuming the risk for both the mental health and the physical medicine side for a number of years, and we've had no problem with managing that risk. And I think you heard from Terry Copeland from LIPA last Tuesday about that also. And he said it's doable. We were talking about the risk, assuming the risk for the mental health, and I think you indicated last Tuesday that that's a doable thing as long as the numbers work. Yeah, we would, and most of the time we'd subcontract back to them. But for the severe and persistent mentally ill, the point we were making here, because they were talking about a carve out of this population, is that most of the cost for this population is in the physical medicine side, so it didn't make sense to carve it out and give that risk to the counties. That risk ought to remain with the fully capitated health plans.
Most of the cost for the severely and persistent mentally ill is on the physical side of the equation.
What it says here. Explain that.
I mean, use the word counterintuitive in here. That runs counterintuitive.
I mean,
if we can call Terry Copeland, he's got the best.
I mean, the biggest driver there is drugs, isn't it?
Or hospitalization.
Well, let's lay out the definition of severe.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Terry Copeland. I'm the CEO of LIPA. I was here, I believe it was last week. the question is about these fairly persistent mental ill patients and the issue of the carve-out, I think is what you were asking.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the cost for these patients, approximately 89% of the cost, is for their physical health care needs. If you include in that the prescription medications as well. So only about 11% is actually for the mental health.
Okay.
Define severely and chronic mentally ill. Maybe.
That's a category of patients that's predefined as to who fits into that.
We're talking apples and apples here.
Yes, sir.
So we're talking group homes, residential care folks here, or
I cannot identify those patients in terms of who they are categorically. Those are handled by the mental health carve out, but I do know the cost because we have a combined data set in Lane County that we can see the entire picture. And I think I have a report that shows the division of those costs. They're very expensive patients. In fact, they're about $500 PMPM on the cost. That's the combined mental health and physical health and drug costs for these patients. Very expensive.
How much of that is just drugs?
There you go.
Probably about 30%. It's about 30%. That would be a combination of prescription drugs and 7-Eleven drugs.
But your psychiatric drugs, and you're counting those on the physical side?
I'm sorry, sir.
Those are psychiatric drugs, and you're counting those on the physical side rather than on the mental health side? Statement here is that most of the costs are on the physical health side. But are you including the psychiatric drugs on the physical health side?
Partially, but about half of the drug cost is prescription drugs, non-7-Eleven. Not mental health. I'm sorry.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I think given the questions, what we'll do is bring this back on Wednesday with some very specific numbers and definitions.
Okay.
And definitions.
This is kind of going counter to some of the stuff.
My experience has been that when you combine the mental health costs in a physical health system, the costs are modest for mental health. But when you start dealing with the adult chronic schizophrenic, I mean, the very serious ones that are in the category you're talking about, it's only true if you don't do what needs doing, which is hospitalize them psychiatrically, keep them under active care, keep their drugs up. I mean, if that's the case, almost all of the costs, it seems in my experience, for those patients are on the mental health side. I mean, you can get in a fight when you carve out as to who pays what. The reality is it's the treatment of the psychiatric illness that drives the cost and not their broken legs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenberg, well, I think we're probably best served if we bring back some very specific numbers to you, along with some definitions of how, you know, who meets that category, that definition.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, when we're talking about a carve-out, we're not just talking about the folks that are currently on the physical health side. We're talking about a carve-out to the folks that are already in residential treatment, and so when I'm talking about assuming the risk, it's for those folks too.
Right.
So, yeah.
A couple quick questions.
Yeah, sure.
Jeff, I guess I'm gonna go to you. I guess on MHO, you run MHO. Most of the plans run some form of MHO. Is that correct?
Correct.
Do those plans also have non-Medicaid MHOs, or can include in their MHOs non-Medicaid patients?
Well, now, family care, this answers your question, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, that family care contracts with what was Ceres and now is Magellan, which basically handles mental health services for commercial insurers plus some Medicaid insurers also. That answers your question.
And ask the question partially, Paul, Mr. Kerr. And in your Medicaid population, do you get reimbursed at the full cost of taking care of those patients as far as mental health is concerned, or is your RVUs lower than you would expect compared to commercial and other rates?
Are you asking, do we get reimbursed by the state?
Your reimbursement's on Medicaid from the state. You're on a capitated business, so it's kind of hard to tell.
Yeah,
but if you were to look at the RVU basis, would you say your Medicaid rates are above, below, or the same as commercial rates?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, our rates that we're paying our mental health providers is below what they would get under the commercial system.
I'll come back to that later when we have a chance to talk. A couple other things real quick, Mr. Chair. LIPA mentioned last time around, Mid Valley is going to take care of the methadone program. What's happening in your methadone program with your plans? I'm thinking you've got a meeting on Thursday, I think, this week, or Wednesday, with the plans. These are questions you might want to talk about. The methadone programs, which have been defunded, I think Mid Valley said they're going to go ahead and pick the cost of that up because it's too expensive not to. The cost shift to them directly immediately is going to be severe. Is that going to be a part of the discussion on this week's plan?
For those plans, I can only speak for family care who has kept part of its standard population. We are covering the methadone drugs for the standard group. Can I believe that the most population is covered?
At least temporarily you're covering.
For the moment, yes.
Last question, Mr. Chair. We've been generating conversation about the duties that WOMAP performs, duties that plans perform, and whether or not it's possible for no extra cost to state or nearly so for some of the OMAP activities to be taken over by the plans. or become more efficiently working with OMAP. Is that going to be part of your discussion this week also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, in regard to that question, when it comes to providing basically capitated health care services, you know, we hope we've addressed that one completely in this response. You know, absolutely, we're looking to take as much of that on as OMAP will let us. With regard to other administrative services, I think we'd have to know, you know, go down those line by line and discuss them. I know the one that was discussed about whether or not we want to take on enrollment. That response that was given on Thursday is the same as COHO would give overall. That's a political hot potato. I don't think we'd want to touch it. Now, whether or not it would be wise to outsource it is a whole different discussion. But from a plan perspective, when you're receiving a premium and making a decision as to whether or not someone's eligible for the plan for which you'll receive a premium, I think that might at least give an appearance of impropriety. And you certainly, we also believe that you really want a single administrator of enrollment services and not multiple for consistency throughout the plan.
And I'm going to ask you guys to please talk into the microphones.
There are people straining in the back, Jeff. And you can project. Come on.
Okay. He's not used to having people wanting to hear what he has to say, Mr. Chair. Big shock for him.
Well, I ask that the member not bring association business into this.
Any other questions? Well, let us go back. At least, speaking for myself, I'm going to equate, particularly on the Tier 2 delivery where you go in items 1 through 6. I want to refamiliarize myself with that, not having the report right in front of me. I appreciate the work you guys put into this. I can tell you put a lot of thought and concern, as we have. There's still work to be done on all of this. So your continued input is going to be vital and valued, and I assume we will be walking many trails together, some of them of tears. Yeah. So
we only exist to serve, Mr. Chair.
That is on the record. Could you say that a little louder?
We only exist to serve, Mr.
Chair. Yeah. Clenched teeth. I don't see anything. Are there any other of the plans that wish to present today? Representative Bates.
Mr. Chair, are there any plans for them to come back and speak to us after their meeting this week? I mean, there's a lot of questions we've posed to them. I'd like to hear what their proposals coming back to us would be. We have given you questions to ask plans as a group.
Correct.
I'd like to hear the response to that as time is ticking away on the session, of what some of the responses might be. Do we have a time certain for them to come back?
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
Representative Bates, we do have, you're going to hear from the physician hospital type organizations tomorrow, which are a different model than you've heard from before. But and just to give the committee a flavor for how they operate, on Wednesday, you're going to have Bill Murray, their guest, and Dave Ford, who will be continuing, I would say, this part of the conversation. So we will get whatever questions we need to them, and hopefully that'll be answered on Wednesday. And we're here every day, so we'll be glad to continue to field questions as they come up. But we'll try and get a lot of them dealt with on Wednesday.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to emphasize, and I'd like you to check out, you know, I know there's a certain rebate percentage for generics and a certain rebate percentage for branded. You know, make sure that what we have in our calculations, if you would, is based on that bifurcated percentages, not just a straight 15-1.
Mr. Chair, that may take, I think we can certainly describe what the rebates are. The calculations, I believe, came out of OMAP.
Right.
And we'll be glad to try and work with them to get those numbers.
I am asking you to ask them,
yeah,
as we will be asking them. I'm not trying to double up OMAP's work. I just want to make sure as we go down this trail, because that's a significant, you know, amount of dollars based on the amount of generics, you know, in all your guys' formularies. And if there's, you know, an additional 4% in there, that's a, you know, a serious miscalculation. It's a number I want to be sure of.
We will look into it.
Any other business come before the committee? Mr. Berkovian, would you please stand, sir?
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Ray. Happy birthday to you.
We are adjourned.
For the record.